We are streaming live on Facebook, so we want to welcome you all. Colin's just quickly ran off to get a can of Johnstone's lager, old speckled hen in his old age. He's switching beers now.
So we are live. Scottish now, look at that.
That is proper Scottish. So we are live with that running podcast. Do you know what it is? It's been that long since we've done one. I also almost forgot the name of the podcast that we did. So we've come back for a one-off special with Mr. Steve Cram. Give us a wave.
Yoo-hoo!
Mr. Tim Hutchins, who we had some technical. It was a bit like being there on a Zoom call with elderly grandparents for a minute there. Give us a wave.
No, I'm just happy I've got my Krabbies, and it's nothing I picked up during lockdown, I can assure you.
And then we also have my best friend, Mr. Colin McCourt. Give us a wave. That was a gentle wave. So we're here today to have a chat through. We've got some great topics for you. It's a bit weird this being live. I feel the pressure a bit more. So first of all, gents, are we all here sat with an alcoholic beverage? What's everybody drinking?
I've got a little Belgian beer. A little early on a Friday, but hey, it's
Tim's
Friday.
Got crabs.
He's always liked a little Belgian.
And Colin's drinking his Scottish Tenants Lager. So... First thing we want to discuss. So in the run-up to the Durham City Run event this weekend, we've all been doing some one-mile time trials. And there was a little bit of banter back and forth where I said if Tim and Steve could run under 5:40, I'd do this podcast with my shirt off. So I'm not sure how it's went yet. So this is a bit nervous. Hence why I'm wearing a Team America vest, easy just to whip off. So first off, Mr. Cram, talk to us, your mile time trial, how did it go and what was it like?
I went to a session at Huddersfield yesterday with Laura. It was very windy, so I sacked off what she was meant to be doing and changed her session. And so I said to her, does that mean I can sack off my mile time trial until the weather's better, i.e. today? And she was like, nah, you gotta do it. So after her session finished, she very dutifully paced me. And Ross, I mean, I do want to see your bare chest like everybody else does. But I'm going to be, it's technology, mate. So I don't know how, but we ran together. Laura paced me the whole way. We started on the proper mile mark on the track. I start my watch. She started hers because I told her she had to run a 91st lap to just and be spot on. So she started it on the start line. So if you see the film, you hear my watch go beep. And then about a second and a half later, she goes beep. And then we run four laps. And when we cross the line, I went beep. And she went beep together. And we were 4 seconds difference. How does that work?
She was in lane two.
I was in lane two. So I'm going to tell you that on Laura's watch, we ran a mile in 5:37.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
On Crammy's watch, I ran 1.67 kilometres, because funny enough, my Garmin is in kilometres these days. And of course, we all know that 1.61 kilometres is a mile.
Is
so
it?
On my watch, yep. I ran 1.67 kilometres, apparently, in 5:41. So... you can either take the 5:41 and ran long distance, taken.
Or show us your nipple,
or you can show us your nipple. Yeah, exactly. So I'm really cool with.
I must.
By
say,
the way,
actually,
by the way, had I known how good I felt in the last 200 and can you believe Waitman? Laura decided. She'd paced me the whole way. Now, what would you do? Like, it's my glory mile. It's my comeback mile. And there was no way Laura was going to let me beat her. There was absolutely no way. I'm giving it that large down the home straight. And Laura's just... Anyway, so yeah, it was...
I thought you've got a bad hamstring.
I have, which is why I went slow early on. Because I was so worried I wasn't going to get round. And then, so I ran like a 79 last lap or something. And like 36... Ryan. 36 for
the last 200. Do you know what it is? I must give you credit here, right? Because the last time I spoke to you, well, you do bits of running and training when you can, but it's not like you do sessions or anything like that. So
no.
You're 60 years old this year. So to be able to go and run a 5:37 is very good. Well done.
I was very happy, thank you. But I now think I can maybe go a little bit quicker.
Right, Timothy. you're up next, amigo. Talk to us.
Well, I can explain everything. I've had a bad calf. I've had a bad calf for a month. A very naughty calf. I did send you all a picture of Beachy Head yesterday, suggesting that's the only way I'm going to get a quick mile done. But I got there this morning, and it was too crowded. So I had to back off. I also put on one of those Nike 4% shoes on one leg, and I just ended up going around in circles. So that didn't work either. Actually, I went for a run on Wednesday, probably about 3 miles, hobbling. And I literally have to do about 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off at the moment. So more seriously, I don't think I could do a mile at the moment.
Sorry, carry on.
Well, nearly, on and off. I couldn't do a mile non-stop at the moment anyway. It comes with age. You'll find out, Steve, when you're 60 in October. So put down 8 minutes for me, and I should be very proud with that.
I think that's still good, Tim. Well done. And then Mr. McCourt.
So I was gearing up for mine.
Can I just jump in and just say, isn't this the age of like 4X runners? Everyone's making excuses and complaints first before they go.
I've got my Strava up, right? That's just white screen and a phone call coming from my sister. Right, I've got one up, whatever. Right, so Monday, getting back into it, ready to go. Just a nice, easy 7 minute mile run. Same on Wednesday, same on Tuesday. Then I put my back out.
Isn't this a Craig David?
Put your back out.
I went for a run on Monday.
I don't know why. Like when I finished my run on Tuesday, my back just spasmed and I haven't been able to run. I can't sleep or anything. But yeah, 6:16 is my best that I ran at the end of that mile. My final mile was 6:16.
I think that's still good, Colin, because I know you haven't run much. And I'm not going to say this in a bragging way, because it's nothing to brag about. I did a 5:12 today at the end of some tempo, and it wasn't pretty, and I was on my knees afterwards, and it was really tough. So anyway,
it was in 4%.
Colin, that effort is fantastic. The last time I saw a picture of you, you're about the size of a family saloon. So I think you've done really well there. I don't know what way you are now.
I'll be honest.
Anything around 6 minutes sounds fantastic.
He's almost back up to that now, guys, to be honest with you.
Pretty much.
Right, yeah. Great. Right, well, I think everybody's had a fantastic job at doing the miles. So well done, all. And whoever's going to be watching this, if you've got your mile this weekend,
Anyone who's watching this, or either live or sometime the next couple of days, don't forget we've got a competition running where Paula's son, Raphael, who's 9, is going to run a mile, and you've got to guess. There's a prize for the person who guesses what time Raf does.
I've heard he's quite a good little runner.
Quicker
actually,
than Raf.
He's, on he's the grid,
not,
right?
He's not, and if he's quicker than 5:37/5:41, I'm not going to be happy. But yes, you're right. He's a good little runner. But yeah, so anyway, so guess what time Raf runs. We should have a snappy...
What's the prize? What's the prize, Steve?
What's the prize, my glamorous assistant? A what? Oh, a framed something.
Something framed.
They're just looking for it now.
In the other room. The house
for
it. Yeah, no, it's...
something framed.
Thing. Yeah, anyway.
Anyway, right, so that actually leads us on quite nicely, Steve. So, obviously, with everything that's happened over the past 6 months, COVID, it's been awful for so many people in so many different ways in so many industries. And obviously, one of the big things that took a hit were the mass participation running events, your park runs, your great city runs, the run-through of it, all your events that you've been doing. So, with the launch of mass events, one of the things I wanted to talk about is, you know, this boom of running and the amount of people who now want to go out and do 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons. It seems to me from, you know, I have no data to back this up, but just from observation, I think over the last 10 years, we've seen such a huge amount of people getting into running. So it's a question to everybody here. What do you think that mass participation events mean to the community? How can it help? And perhaps how can it actually get more people involved in athletics in the future, and could we see a knock-on effect over the next, you know, 20 years, where we see young kids who are going to junior park runs or young park events with their parents, getting them involved in the sport, getting them involved in running, and do you think that could then end up leading to, you know, higher standards of endurance running in the UK? Shoot,
what was the question?
I'm joking.
Right, I'll throw a couple of things out there, and then let the other guys come in. First of all, here and now, I'm a bit miffed, to be honest, on behalf of those of us who organise events. Tim does as well. We've got the Brighton marathon, I think, was postponed to September, and I'm not sure whether you've had to cancel it yet. Now, so we've cancelled three events. We've got two that we're hanging on for, but who knows? I'm a little bit miffed. I mean, all those things that you just said there, Ross, and I understand why. You know, you can now go to the opera. You can go to, is it Glyndebourne? I should probably know what it is, you know.
I need to brush up on my opera knowledge, to be honest with you.
And obviously the art, and it's great that the arts have got a support package, a very big support package, because the arts are important. But the health of our nation is the number one thing at the minute. And yes, people can go out and exercise, of course they can, but people need motivation to do that. You know, they need to be inspired to do that. And mass events over the last 15, 20, 30 years have been the way to do that. Running, cycling, triathlons, you know, all these, you know, tough mudders, whatever it might be. And it is a big industry, and there's a lot of economics involved in it. But, you know, I think we've all been waiting for a bit of guidance on this. We understand, of course we all do, but it is outdoors, and we can put events together of a certain size with certain social distancing rules in place and restrictions and all the rest of it. But keeping people fit and active is going to be even more important going forward. So I'm a bit disappointed that we haven't had more from the government to describe some sort of pathway over the next few months, because other countries have done, and they've started that process. You know, our sport has been up and running in a lot of countries around Europe in a competitive way, but also they start to have smaller, you know, up to 500, maybe up to 1,000, whatever it might be. So yeah, it's going to be difficult to hold the London Marathon or the Great North Run, and you know, obviously Great North Run's already gone, but smaller events that people can aim for, and park runs. You know, why can't we get park runs back up quickly? Because they're typically a few hundred people. And you know, you made the point, Ross, 40,000 kids do a park run every weekend, normally on the Saturday and the Sunday in the 5K or the 2K, isn't it? 40,000 kids every weekend, you know, and that, those sort of numbers are important. So I am a bit miffed on the behalf of events. I think we've been kind of put in a pot with things like pop festivals and, you know, big outdoor gatherings, where people have a drink and you know, it's very, very different in terms of how people move around. So yeah, I was hoping that, I think we were all hoping that there would have been a bit more guidance, a bit more, you know, with all the announcements that are going on about getting back to normal. Of course, that's about getting the economy moving, but we should also be trying to, I think, help people to, you know, have events and the rest of it. And by the way, it is a business, it is big business, Tim will know that. You know, there's lots of ancillary companies who are involved in putting outdoor events on as well. So, you know, it's not right that that sector has not yet got a plan going forward.
I think what's frustrating is that representatives of a group of the big events, including the Brighton Marathon, have made proposals. They put papers to government, and they've received a fairly lukewarm reception, as I understand it. And I think you're right, Steve. I think, you know, one of the major things that, for example, just taking Brighton as a microcosm, you know, in Brighton there's a huge Pride weekend, tons of alcohol and other stuff being consumed, and you know, we have in the past on occasion felt as though we've been thrown in the same pot as them, putting on a marathon where there is not alcohol, there's great discipline, there's great sensible behaviour going on through tens of thousands of people throughout the weekend, and yeah, it is frustrating that bigger events can't go on. I think the problem, of course, is that while you can control your events and you've got the roadway, which is your field of play, you can't control spectators. There are factors that are out of your control. And that's why I think some events are looking at contained environments, be it a stately home or an airfield or your back garden, Steve, would probably do actually, for a reasonable size event. That sort of stuff is being proposed. And yeah, we've got plans in Brighton, announcements to be made, things still being worked upon. We haven't cancelled yet. Our date, as it things stand, is September the 20th. London's is October the 4th. And yeah, everybody is kind of adjusting their behavior and waiting for the next announcement from government. Really, really frustrating times.
So, Colin, I'll bring you in. So, obviously, we've just chatted there about, you know, what the events mean to the community and how it's been dealt with around the COVID-19 pandemic. So, as you, somebody who, you know, you were competing not too long ago, coming through the system a while ago, coming through the system has been probably relatively fresh in your mind, and also you've got two young children. Uh-huh. Do you think that these events, what do you think they'll do for the performance? Do you think mass participation running is going to drive better performances in 5, 10, 15 years, as I said, with younger kids coming into the events, getting people involved? Do you think that's going to help the standard of British running from an elite perspective?
I don't think so at the beginning. I think it was a struggle at the beginning when the pandemic started because people didn't really know what to do. But I think once everybody sort of got in a groove and got their kids out and started going running and stuff, like my entire street goes out pretty much. I like live in a cul-de-sac. And they go out running and stuff every day. So you will see that knock-on effect eventually, but it's the conversion rate that's really important, because you'll have all these people right now, thousands and thousands of people going out running every day. But what happens when they go back to work? What happens when normality starts to kick back in? Do they turn up to events? If people aren't allowed to put events on right now, for example, right? To say like for Brighton Marathon, for example, right? If they're allowed to put on a race in the next few months or whatever, they hit strike while the iron's hot and drag all them people that have been out training. They'll think, oh, you know what? I've been going running for a month or two or however. If I enter a race now, because there is one, that then drags them through. But the longer that is then left, the more chance you've got of them stopping and going back into their normality of not running and just going in back to work and stuff. So I think it's a really fine line right now between picking them people up and making sure that the advertising and everything is right and is targeting the right people and getting in there and dragging them from their couch to 5K that they've been doing over the course of this into the races and into stuff and into athletics. Whether that happens or not, I don't know, but it's a struggle because people will automatically, majority of them will go back to their normal lives.
Don't you think though that actually an awful lot of have reassessed our lives and we'll never go back to the same regimes, and so many people have found the great outdoors to be sort of kind of rather wonderful, a bit of a revelation for a lot of people. I mean, I know for a fact that hordes of people are trying to get out of London, move out of London, people with money, you know, you live in London, duh. So in these areas around London, the home counties as we could call them, apparently there are a lot of estate agents are inundated with people wanting to get out of London. So that's not a temporary adjustment to their life. And I would like to think that a lot of people are feeling positive about just being healthier, enjoying the outdoors more, enjoying nature, birds and bees and back gardens or whatever it may be. It would be disappointing if what you say is a danger came to be, Colin.
I just think... I do think that you're right. I think there's a lot of change that has happened and people are a lot more, the word is like woke, isn't it? Like people are like they're thinking differently about their lives and everybody is in that. But my concern with all the fitness and stuff, because I've done it myself, is that people get to a certain point and if there's no outlet for them, which they haven't got right now because they can only go for a run for themselves. They only can look at Strava and all that stuff. If there's no races or end goals for people to aim to, people will tail off. So unless that can come pretty soon and the ability to be able to put on races, because America are putting races on, like they're putting on mountain running races and trail races and stuff like that. And they're the highest level of COVID in the world now. And they're putting on socially distancing events. I watched a guy on YouTube the other day run an ultra marathon through the trails, 50K. They were setting them off 10 at a time. Like, why can't that be something that you would be able to...
Yeah, I think we're all going to have to think differently. And like Tim said, they're looking at things. We've, Kielder, we haven't cancelled Kielder yet. And so Kielder's a good example of what you're both saying. You know, it's not somewhere spectators go. Everyone tends to go to Kielder to run the 10K or the half marathon or the marathon across the weekend. So we can kind of spread the whole thing out a little bit. We've got a lot of space to do that sort of thing. It would have to be a bit different to what we've done before. You're right, we'd have to kind of let people go in smaller waves than maybe people are used to. But we can go and run, and we're on trails, and we're out, and we haven't got thousands of spectators to deal with, and that's good. So you've got this kind of, combining what Tim was saying, let's get into the great outdoors. It might mean moving out the city centres a little bit, which is really helpful. You know, and we've this weekend, as you know, we are part of the Durham City Run Festival, what you guys are doing. Thank you so much for doing this. But you know, we've had our first virtual event with Sunderland, the virtual event that's happening around this. So people are getting a medal and they're getting a t-shirt and they're getting a goodie bag for what they do this weekend. It isn't in groups, it's on their own. But you know, we had over 1,000 people do the Sunderland one. It'll be more in this one. And that's great, you know. So you're right, Colin. You've got to give people, even if it has to be virtual, or we have to go somewhere we're not used to going and do it in a little different way. We've got to keep giving people the options to feel as though they've got something to aim towards. But I still, as I said, I still don't understand why I mean, I've seen triathlon have put some great stuff out. I must say that we're still really waiting to see stuff coming from UK Athletics around how you would put road race. Yeah, there's lots of people, as Tim was said, within the industry have been sharing thoughts and ideas. And I've been listening to people from around the world, how they're doing it, what they're doing, trying to take that on board. But you need direction. We have to do it within whatever the rules are here in the UK. So we need the government. We'll need our federation as well to lay out a bit of a plan that we can all then work towards. But they should be doing that now, really, if we have anything going this year.
So I think that rounds that off pretty nicely. And I think one of a lot of the questions that we got asked were about Kipchoge's 2-hour marathon and what everybody's thoughts were. So I'll be keen to get a bit of a sense of what you guys think of it. Now, for me personally, watching him run that sub 2-hour marathon was great. It was entertaining. I thought it was great for the sport to be built, to kind of get a lot of momentum, a lot of conversation going. I thought it was a really positive thing. That being said, to me, it's still not a marathon world record and it's not recognized properly. And, you know, you're seeing in the news, sub 2-hour marathon done. It's like, well, yes and no, it's not really, because it's not done at a proper city marathon. It was done in such controlled environments. It was a great experiment, right? Could a human being run sub 2 hours? Yes, they can. But actually, for me personally, it has to be done at a London, a Berlin, a New York, or a Brighton marathon. Imagine that. That'd be brilliant, wouldn't it? So, or Kielder, that would be more impressive. Yeah. So what it would be is... So for me, it's like, it's a bit of a gimmick, but it's still fun. It's still exciting, super positive for the sport, but it's not really, no one's really ran a sub 2-hour marathon yet, in my opinion. The world record is still 2:01, I think it is. So for you guys, Steve and Tim, who have to, you know, you commentate, you probably get asked this a lot. What are your thoughts on the whole charade around the 2-hour marathon? I'm so eloquent, guys.
That was beautifully put. I mean, it is a giant can of worms, and we don't want to delve too deep into this can of worms because there's some big buggers at the bottom. But
Tim's going fishing later. He needs those worms. He's opening them. He's getting
them. Exactly. Enough about worms. I think you know, he was a bit. It was a bit of a lab rat job. You're right. It was an experiment. What happened in Vienna? I didn't even watch it. I haven't seen it. I've seen about the last 100 meters. I was working at the Chicago Marathon, I think, that weekend, which was a great race. You know, and I do like racing. That's a sustainable. I say this again and again. Racing, man against man, woman against woman, is a sustainable, attractive value of our sport. And time trials and record breaking, 99% of the time is destined for disappointment. You know, it did break a bunch of the rules, and those rules have stood in place and been fine for about 30 or 40 years now. There's a consistency to the sport, and therefore comparisons have been possible for decades. And this whole, what did you call it?
Charade.
Around these
isn't that what you play at Christmas with your nan? Film.
No.
Steady on.
I'm joking.
I hope not. She's been dead for years. They both have. It's disappointing because it stops comparisons. We're in a new era now. It's a bit like when people are saying, oh, in 2000, why don't we just kill off all the world records and we'll start new records? And, you know, it's kind of tough on quite a few people like Jonathan Edwards and so on, who I think were probably clean when they set the world record. And likewise, this would be, this sort of is enforcing a new age on the sport, a new era where you can't make proper comparisons. Who knows what... Kylie would run in these shoes and so on. People are setting ridiculous personal bests left, right and centre. I wouldn't feel satisfied with it. I'm not in position to be a good runner at the time these shoes have come out. But I think the whole thing leaves a bad taste in my mouth. I know that it does. And I don't believe what I'm seeing anymore. That's the really sad
thing. Tim, you do... Now,
you know, that's nothing to do with doping. That's a completely separate can of worms. The shoes have changed the sport dramatically, and I don't think for the better.
Just on one thing, I do agree with you, but highly ran-in shoes that were designed by the guy that made the Nike shoes with the same plate, and he broke the world record in them, and Turgut had a pair which are pretty much exactly the same. So both of them had carbon fiber shoes for their world record marathons, plus their 10Ks on the track. So I don't know if that changes your perspective.
No, I'm glad you've...
Both of them were going to breaking world records for many years before that. So their career profiles kind of came to a logical climax with those world records in the marathon. And the Nike shoes, there may have been similar technology around, but there's been a seismic leap almost literally with these shoes that are coming out now. It's a great shame because everybody's trying to join the race. It's become a rat race.
I think that was a good point from Colin, though. And I think at the time, and I suppose the difference is, so Turgut and Hailey had this carbon-plated shoe, and it gave them an advantage, and nobody seemed to have an issue with it. But obviously, we're talking about essentially what Nike have done is they've taken the best bits of all the shoes over the years, put them into one to make them this super shoe, and people probably aren't happy because people think it gives you too much of an advantage. So people are okay with a little bit of an advantage, but when it becomes too much of an advantage, it seems like people have an issue. But I think, Colin, you made a good point when you're saying, you know, people didn't have an issue with it then. So where do you draw the line of, well, you can have a shoe that helps you a bit, but not too much. It's like quite a grey area that doesn't really have any like objective metrics that you can say, well, this is okay and this isn't. Steve, I know you wanted to comment on that, so go on.
All right, I'm going to try and do three quick things here. First thing, the two-hour charade, as you called it. We've got to be really careful. You're right, it was a manufactured event, and Tim's right in what he said. I did watch it. As a television event, though, it was really good, and it shone a massive spotlight on the sport, good or bad, but it was essentially good. And the sport needs that. The sport is not delivering anymore in the sense that we all understood. Certainly Tim and I would have understood. So you've got to accept that the purest form of it, that the Olympics and the World Champs will still get an audience. And some other things will still get an audience. But the world is different now. And even the Inspiration Games, which was a mad thing we did, you know, with athletes in seven different places and three athletes on the screen. It was mad and it was different, and Noel Lyles theoretically ran a world record, which wasn't to be. But you know, guess what? Those are the things that put them. That you know, Noel Lyles doing that thing got top of all the, you know, the hits on the websites and all that. And so Noel Lyles is more famous now than he was before. Okay, not in a conventional way. The point I'm trying to make is the sport cannot afford to not have some kind of gimmicky things going on, mm-hmm. that we know it's not the Olympics, we know it's not the World Championships, we know it's not a world record. And actually, the fact that some members of the media and the public maybe think it is doesn't really matter, because there's a lot of things they don't understand about our sport. I don't understand some of the things that go on in cycling, and you know what I still don't know what the Kirin is, you know. But it's so the sport has to be open to having things like that happen, particularly if they're big news and they get people who wouldn't normally watch our sport watching, because that's a way in. And if they the next time Eliud Kipchoge runs the London Marathon, they go, oh, he's the guy who brought the sub 2 hour, I've heard of him. Whereas normally, how hard would it be for us to sell Eliud Kipchoge, as good as he is and as famous as he is, to those of us in the sport? So that's that. Okay, very quickly, shoes. Two sides of this, and I'm still not say I'm on the fence, but so two sides to this. I think technology has always been part of our sport, and advancement has always been part of our sport. And I've sat at lunches with Roger Bannister and the fantastic Ron Delaney and people like Jim Ryan, and you know what they were doing in their day, bore no comparison to what we were doing in our day. Tracks, shoes, altitude training, you know, all of these things, which you can argue that's available to everybody, and this is the key point. So we have to accept that technology moves all sport on, as long as, and there's the key thing, that's fine. And we have to accept people are going to get better because of the use of better sports science, better sports medicine, better equipment, the rest of it. But as long as all of that is generally available to everybody who wants to compete, I'm cool with it. It's when it's only available to certain people that it becomes a problem. And that's the perception around the shoes, isn't it? And it's that's when the federation have got to be incredibly strong around going, that shoe you can't use for whatever reason, or you can use. So we have to rely on the federation doing that. And the argument is there as to whether they've done a good or a bad job on that. And that's, you know, maybe discuss that further. But I'm just going to put through one last element into this. A coach, and obviously Laura's, people will know Laura Waitman. So everyone started wearing the spikes last year, yeah? And getting these brilliant times. So when Laura ran
spikes.
Yeah, when Laura ran 8:26 in well, it wasn't in it was the Eugene meet.
California.
California.
Yeah. San Fran or whatever.
Guess what everybody said? It was the shoes.
Did you have this spikes?
She wasn't wearing them. She wasn't wearing them. But and when the Schweitzer and Houlihan
wasn't wearing them.
Exactly. So we everyone suddenly jumps on top of it. And actually, when those girls ran the time, Laura's initial reaction was, wow, how do they do that or whatever. But actually, you know, Laura's running in Monaco in a few weeks' time. What it's done with her is when she sees Safwan Hassan or Coco go hard or Laura Muir, it raises Laura's expectations of what she needs to do, okay? Mm-hmm. So when she ran 8:26, it was because of the hard work she'd put in. And she was disappointed that people just went, it's the bloody shoe. So we shouldn't underestimate also that athletes these days have lots of things available to them. And when they really are hothouse, and I'm not saying we are hothousing, but we know in America the what's going, and by the way, you know, it's very easy to time trial. I say very easy. It's very easy when there's no Olympics, there's no world championships, nothing really going on, and you just train, and they run 2-3 races, got themselves ready for that, and then bang, go out and do that. Still impressive, but still believable, in my view. There've been a handful of unbelievable performances.
But shoes aside, Steve, at least they were adhering to the rules in those races. I watched them earlier today, both that women's 5,000 and Mo Ahmed in his 12:47. Yeah. At least they ran 12 and a half laps in those times. The Elliott thing in Vienna,
I wouldn't say
it's farcical, but it was loads of the rules. They cherry-picked the rules that they wanted to keep and threw out rules they didn't like.
100% with that. My point about that was, though, that's okay, and athletics, track and field, needs to do a bit more of that. Whether it's pole vaults in the railway station, whether it's, you know, whether it's two hours in the middle of Vienna, you know, whether it's a mile down the centre of Newcastle, I don't know, but we've got to do things which aren't the rules. You know, Ross obviously ran a downhill mile to get his 5:12. That was obvious. So, you know, let's find some things where we get our stars and we put them in a slightly different context to show how good they are. You know, they've still got to go and, you know, throw the javelin and it's not the competition but we want that then to translate back so people will watch them when the World Championships are on, will watch them when, you know, the Olympics are on. And that's something I never used to think that way, but obviously I think probably, you know, I've watched the TV audiences for athletics dwindle, you know, in the last 10, 15 years. And
since you started broadcasting, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, the world is different, but it's a trend. It's a trend. And you know, I think we all know that when the Olympics are on, people come back and watch it. But it will really help if they'd seen, you know, people get famous for going on Strictly Come Dancing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think one of the things I'll come in on that, and then I think our listeners, you know, everybody loves nostalgia. So I'd like to say that's a nice word for you. I'd like to come back and I'd like to actually just talk to you. I'd like to actually go to some topics because I think our listeners would be disappointed.
Yeah, come on, yeah, because we'll move on from the 2 hours thing.
Because they want to do that. But I think just one quick point to your thing, Steve, about, you know, being innovative and perhaps chucking the rule books away to keep athletics forefront of mind. one thing you may have seen in the news was the YouTubers boxing KSI Logan Paul, right? So initially the boxing fans were like, the boxing fans were like, this is ridiculous, this is farcical, these are just YouTubers. It was, I think, Colin Young, it was the highest
A £1 million, the guy.
And off the back of that, on YouTube, they've got lots of new young boxing supporters who now have taken an interest in boxing because their favourite YouTuber has been doing this. And I think, final point, Athletics need to do things like that, whether it's Mo Farah teams up with a KSI and they do a DMR relay. And it might not be, but to get new people into the sport, it needs to be done. That's the last thing we'll say. Right, nostalgia. Let's go to it. Let's go back in time. Let's rewind. So, Steve, actually, on the topic of boxing as well. So, it's rumoured that Mike Tyson is going to be doing a, is it a third or a fourth fight with Evander Holyfield as two guys? Yeah, so they're gonna get together. Mike Tyson's been putting up his training videos and he looks ridiculously dangerous for a man of 50-odd years old. So, Steve, my question is, Seb and Steve Ovett, if you were given a year now and you're all paid £2 million, just chucking that number out there, with a cash prize, £2 million on the finish line, and you had to re-race that LA Olympics, although Ovett didn't make the final, but we'll give him a pass. And you've got a mile race, you got a year to train.
He did make the final.
I thought he dropped out.
He dropped out just after the bell.
All right, don't rub it in. He could be watching this. Don't be horrible. Anyway, so you've got a year to train. There's £2 million on the prize line. You, Seb versus Steve, back in. Who wins that race? That's Tim as well. If Tim wants to come in, we'll chuck Tim in. But who wins that classic race, the classic rivalry? Who wins?
Me.
No, the race doesn't happen. It's a bit like the Moorcroft, the Ovett and Co. thing that Andy Norman tried to arrange back in the 80s. One of them was injured all the time. It never really happened. So you three would all be injured all the time.
Exactly. We'd end up pushing it. So whoever, it would be last man standing. I think that's what it would be. Whoever could sustain a bit of training, not get injured, play
a little
hobble
to the start line.
Yeah, exactly. And then on the day, kind of like see who, because.
Do you not think that would be a good thing, though? Like, it would be quite funny, right? Honestly,
stupid.
Listen to me. Right? No. If you, at the next Diamond League, the British Diamond League next year, so Spencer Barden, whoever's running it, if you're watching now, imagine you could put to the press, even if Ovett's in Australia, he doesn't do it, Steve Cram and Seb Coe race again after 40 years to do a race. Like, that would be a bigger thing. You just said you wanted new gimmicky events to get athletics in the sport. So if you're not
I'd pay money to see that.
I would pay money to see that.
If you're an old golfer, right? Arnold Palmer, bless him, when he was around, used to still be able to come to the Open every year and hit a golf ball. Okay, he didn't hit as far as he used to, but it was still him hitting a golf ball. Tennis players even can still hit without moving around so much. Fine. Singers, Tom Jones is 80 and still singing. People pay to go and listen to him sing. He doesn't sing as good as he used to, but hey.
People would still pay to see you two running a sub
slogging out a 6 minute mile.
Right. Absolutely pay for it.
Going back to what the mile that we did, that I did yesterday, and Dan, Laura's boyfriend, was filming it and he sent some clips of it. Do you know how slow 6 minute miling looks on
it's
camera?
It's awful, isn't it? It is horrific.
I'm running down, and then they show it on film, and you go, "Well, we're just jogging." Do you know how decathletes look? Decathletes when they're doing a 1500, look like they're just plodding, and they're still running 5 minutes for 1500, and they look like they're just plodding.
People love a rivalry. People love a race, and people would pay to see it. Right. So.
Do you know when I realised I was really past it? I was running in a 10K in Brighton about 20 years ago, and I was running along behind this bloke mid-race, and I thought, God, he's going slowly. And I wasn't catching the bugger. And that's when you take a huge swallow, your pride goes out the window, and you actually recognise your own age.
I tell you what I would do. I'd be happy to kind of have a go at like a marathon or a half marathon or something. But I just think like
people want the mile.
I know they do, but it would
they
just
want the mile. You've got to give the people what they want.
Just look crap, you know.
No, but right. Listen, we've got so many questions.
Do you know what would happen? We'd jog three laps just to, and then on the last lap probably I'd go first, and then Seb would be waiting for something to ping. I think we'd leave Ovette. And then he'll try and come past me. I'll try and respond. And it literally would be whoever gets the finish line without something going.
And that sounds incredibly entertaining.
You've got my money, so let's go.
Yeah, exactly. Right, Tim, actually, on this topic,
I've just tweeted it out. I just tweeted out it's happening. So.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We've had so many questions.
Just after the Olympics.
Go on. We've had so many tech questions. Sorry, I'm conscious I haven't got you for too long, so I want to get these questions done. Right, Tim, first one for you. Right, so this was sent in. Here we are.
Oh, by my ex-wife, I hope.
Yeah. Why did you do that, you bastard, John? Who do you think you are? No, seriously, right. Tim, do you think distance runners try to break the field less these days? If so, why? It seems like all distance runners think they have the best kick and wait until the last lap. In 1986, you broke the field and got a bronze medal. Where are all the brave runners like John Ngui, Ishmael Kari? Have the stronger runners moved to the roads?
Yes, a huge proportion of good runners have moved to the roads. It's not as possible to break fields these days because there are so many great runners. You know, races back then would have two or three standout individuals. Now there are eight or nine standout individuals. So you get a pack moving around at 13-minute pace. You can't break fields so easily these days. You don't get so many tactical races. Thank God, championships, because that's where it happens. And, you know, you'd see Steve kick in and grab 5 metres off the field, and then they'd wake up and it was too late. And, you know, it's what makes championships special. You see racing. And, you know, Steve and I commentate in the Diamond League. There probably are too many pace-made races. I would love to see races won in 3:38, 3:41 with a 51 last lap, you know, and a bit of cat and mouse going on.
Great. And then, Steve, got a question for you. So, this is a very eloquently put question. I've used that word twice.
Obviously today. Not written by you, then.
No. The year is 1988. And the month is October. The race is the Olympic 1500-meter final. Do you now, with hindsight, run that race any differently, like you did in the heat when you opened up with 300 meters to go? Surely that was the day to become Olympic champion.
A great
question, by the way. This is what.
In the same way that Tim doesn't watch that 2-hour thing, I've never watched this race again. It's one of the worst races I ever ran. I wasn't
fifth in the Olympics.
So you all three of you will know that if you're not 100% fit, you don't necessarily do the things that you should do. And that was the mistake I made. And probably if it had happened to me in 1982, I would have just tried to do the right thing. And I got sucked into kind of, waiting for something to happen. So two things happened. One is, the Kenyans in the race were definitely beatable, but they got moving. And I was in a bad position when they got moving. And you've got two options then. One is to wait and hope that, and there were still lots of people around. So I decided to kind of stay where I was, which really wasn't what I used to do. And that's me not kind of, you know, having, I'm not in great shape, therefore. And when I started to really panic about trying to get out, which was about 350 meters to go, there was a tall, lanky American called Jeff Atkinson. You remember him? No?
I wasn't born, so no.
Yeah. Anyway, he basically got in my way. He got in my way in a way which I couldn't get round him, and he was like a wall in front of me. And that, being held up there, Peter came by, Peter Elliott, so everyone was kicking, and we're trying to chase them down. And by then the race was on, and I sort of maintained, but there was no way I was making up the ground. I should have been in a completely different position. I hated every second of, I walked off the track in complete and utter disgust. You just want to rewind, October, would I do something different again? 100%. I don't think I would have run one step of that race the same.
That was one of those weird races though, wasn't it? You know, an Olympic final, and as I say, championship racing is always throws up weird things. Peter Rono, who ever heard of what he did after
the only
that race
he ever really won. A good one to win. Good one to win.
Tiny little Kenyan nobody had ever heard of. I bet he wasn't even the top-ranked Kenyan in that championship.
No, and you know what? He did what would have been lovely for me. You have taken it out, leading it on. You know, like, it would be nice to have someone just, you know, in normal circumstances, I'd be happy to be on the back of somebody doing that and getting the race moving. Never mind.
Tim, yes. Right, the one we've got for you.
It's ruined his Friday, Ross.
sorry, Steve. Oh, get me another beer. Make it a crate. Anyway, Tim, two World Cross Country silver medals showed you could take on the best in the world, especially in Stavanger, when you beat the best Africans apart from the best ever cross-country runner, John Ngui. If Tim was in 1990 shape today and had all of the advantages, where do you think you would finish in the World Cross Country Championships? Still top three, ?
Oh my God, nowhere near. No, I think, you know, it was the pre-African era. I mean, a Kenyan was first, I was second, and a Kenyan was third. So they were around, but there just weren't dozens of them. I think I'd be finishing the top 15. I'd probably finish the top 15, 20. You know, I think you've got to recognise that those lads are probably the Kenyan team are all in 27-30 shape or quicker. You know, and actually, for a lad from Britain or Norway or France or Germany had been 27-30 shape in March, you're doing pretty well. I suspect I was in 27-30 shape when I ran that race in Stavanger. But Ngugi beat me by 28 seconds. You know, he made me feel incredibly mortal. I think it was, still is, didn't really publicise this, the biggest winning margin there's ever been in the men's senior world cross country. Horrible feeling. It didn't feel humiliated because, you know, you got a world championship silver medal. But the guy was from a different planet. I mean, his femurs were all wrong. They were far, far too long. He was weird. You can watch the video and he's skipping over puddles like he doesn't weigh anything. So, I really do think I'd be somewhere in the high teens. Like that.
I mean, just very quickly, and then we'll get through these questions for the rest of you. I think you're being quite hard on yourself when we talk about the Kenyans, and not to get too controversial right now, but based on the amount of doping offences that have come out of Kenya in the last few years, I think, you know, this whole illusion of Kenyan dominance now has to be questioned. Anyway, moving on to the next question. Steve,
that's very quick, Ross.
This person said, the next two people, next this is the question that was sent in was, I reckon the best shape you've possibly ever been in was for the Commonwealth Games 800 metres in 1986, when with no wind you could have run 1:41 for the 800 metres. When do you think you were at your very best, and what do you think you could have run that day?
Fair point. I was doing another interview about such things a couple of days ago. Yeah, and I think I said 1986. The interview was about 1985, and I said I think I was in better shape in 1986. Partly we had two championships: Commonwealth first, and then the Europeans. I had obviously fantastic 1985. I had a good winter. I was just really strong, and then it was the first time I was going to double up. So I'd got, you know, I was really keen to contest both events well. I was expecting to face Seb and Peter Elliott. I mean, you know, even at the Commonwealth Games, and who wasn't there? Kenyans weren't there? I can't remember now. I wasn't worried about any of them at the time. It was, you know, Peter Elliott and Seb were two of the best in the world at the time. And then you throw in Tom McKean for a bit of interest and others. So I was really ready for that. And then Seb got myxomatosis or something. I can't remember what it was. He was, you know, he turned up on
that's
the,
what
on
rabbits
the,
get.
Yeah, I know. It was something like that. It was on the 6 o'clock news. I remember sitting in the hotel in Edinburgh and he turned up, you know, Seb would have his tracksuit zipped up and did the whole, you know, I'm not well and I'm not going to race. So that freed me up a little bit, but I still had Peter and Tom and stuff. So yeah, I mean, I think what could I have run? I don't know. So what did I ran low 1:43s and on a fairly breezy day in Edinburgh, and then the 1500. Remember when Gladwin?
I'll say it for you, Steve. It was blowing a bloody gale. You ran 3:43 something. Tom McKean was in great shape, and he made him look ordinary, same as he did John Gladwin in the 1500. And Johnny was a 3:51 miler. You'd have run 1:41, no trouble.
That is the reason where you just kept going away, Dan. You went four and just kept going and going and going and it stretched. That's that race, isn't it?
The 800 was great and I felt great. And then I think, you know, you're always taught not to get a bit cocky and things. And when I went the 1500 final, you know, John was obviously one of the contenders. And when he took off, I was at the back kind of. I had said to you know, my team, my group, that I wasn't going to kind of, because some people said, oh, go and put a show on, you know, and I thought, no, you know, that's not, it's a championship race, you treat it with respect and you go. But I had thought to myself, I might just see like the last 300, you know, bang. And one way to make me run harder was not to be in the front with 300. So I had decided I didn't want to be at the front with 300 to go. I wanted to kind of be going at people, mm-hmm. And see, because I had the European Championships coming up and I knew that probably Seb was going to be back for that. And I wanted to know, like, what can I do the last 300 in, sort of thing. So I'm, and John took off, you know, he took off with whatever. And I didn't, I wasn't watching. I was at the back. I mean, and I moved out down the home straight with 500 to go. And I went, bloody hell. And John could, you know, John could run a hard last 500, 600. You know, he was no slouch. And so I'm off after him. And I remember I got 300 to go thinking, I might not catch him. But he'd gone so hard. And then about 250, I started reeling him in and then, you know, went past him and stuff. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's very kind of you to say that, Tim, but I don't know. I think I probably would have run quicker than 142.8, which was my best. And I might have been able to, if had it been a non-championship year, it would have been lovely to have had a good crack at a 1500 other mile, but we didn't.
Yeah.
Great. Tim, question for you. So taking Mo out of the equation, how does today's crop of distance runners compare with the greats of the 70s and 80s?
That's a tough one. You know,
I think if we think about the 1500 meter runners, so your Jakes, your Charlies, Josh Kerrs, Neil Gurley's, and then then obviously your Butch Hart, your Mark Scott's, Chris Thompson, all those guys.
I don't think you're comparing like with like, and there are big differences. Firstly, in the fact that back in the 70s and 80s, club running was so huge. Running and club athletics and hard training was much more widespread. I always describe it as pyramids, you know, and you look at a club like Gateshead where, you know, Bren would go out for a 10-miler on a Wednesday evening or whatever, and there'd be 20 blokes going out and doing the same thing, you know, and they'd go around in 55 minutes or whatever it may be. Good club runners were to a penny, and they trained bloody hard to run their 2:25 in London or their 49-minute 10-miler and everything. Nowadays, if you're a club runner, you're almost regarded as elite. I mean, in this little village I live in, Sussex, there's a big running community, but they go, ooh, are you a club runner? You know, it's weird. So the pyramid was much bigger then. Now the pyramid is smaller at the bottom, and therefore it has to be sharper. And the guys are getting so much more backup. They're getting so much more help. Dietitians, nutritionists, or other physios, psychiatrists, psychotherapists, you name it. They're being flown off to, you know, wherever, whether it's Flagstaff or Kenya for their training. We didn't get that support. I was a self-employed businessman under you, Bob. Used to go off to San Moritz for 4 weeks under my own steam, go off to Kenya for 4 weeks under my own steam, paid every penny, because guess what? I was a self-employed businessman. So I think they do have it good now, a lot of the lads, but they're coming from much smaller talent pools, so they need that help. And there's some fantastic runners about, but for sure, there aren't as many of them. And that's why each little bit of talent that's discovered, whether it's Andy Butchart or Tom Farrell or whatever, needs to be nurtured more carefully.
Great answer. Right, Crammy, final one for you. So we'll do one more serious one and then we'll get on to a bit of more lighthearted questions. So Steve, does a fit, and don't sit on the fence with this, don't, you've got to go for it. I want you just to be honest. Does a night
Sunderland fit, every time.
No. That's coming. Don't you worry okay. about that. Does a fit 1985 Steve Cram win in Beijing, London, or Rio?
Well, all three of them.
Just one.
Yeah. You can't say you will win, but could you win? Yes. I mean, there's not. You know, I haven't seen anything in the last, you know, 30, 40 years that I wouldn't have loved racing against. You know, there's no athletes there.
The 1500 hasn't moved on, actually.
No, not really.
You'd only have to run a 50 to win 50, I think, to win London.
Yeah, but I've done that before. So
that's what I mean. So, like, it's not like you wouldn't be able to do
that. But you know, what you do is you race to the people you're racing against, don't you? So, I mean, there's been some people I would have loved to run against, but yeah, there's been plenty of people who've, you know, as Tim said, people, fast times are not the, you know, they're part of what we do, and the Diamond League serves a purpose for that. But racing's the important thing. That's what I live for. It's what Tim lived for. It's what you guys did as well. You know, and you, so you, what you think, particularly in the 1500, is how would I beat him? You know, and so, no, I don't think anything's happened. Like Tim said, things haven't exactly shifted a massive amount to the point where, you know, I think, yeah, which actually sometimes is why I get frustrated, because I kind of look at things going, you know, you guys don't, you know, you don't realize what opportunity you have to go. And that's why I've been, it's been quite good in recent years to see, I don't know, people like Central winning medals and, you know, at the highest level and stuff. So, so, you know, there's still room in the 1500 for that to happen, which is good.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Isn't it interesting? So I was just going to say, final comment on that. It's interesting, isn't it, that 8 and 15 haven't really moved on against the clock. Okay, Rudisha set a world record, but, you know, you look at the top 20 in 85 and you look at the top 20 in 2015 or last year, and they're not that different, really. 5,000 and 10,000, totally different ball game, different world. Now, a bunch of reasons about that, some which I can mention on here and some which I can't, but, you know, it's in the distances where huge leaps forward have been made.
And then finally for you, Tim, which gives you more pleasure, looking back at the Olympic fourth place, European bronze, or any of your world cross country medals?
Oh God, I don't know. I've never thought about it like that. I mean,
think about it now.
Fourth is a pretty crappy place to finish, but c'est la vie. I was coaching myself pretty much in 89 when I came second in the World Cross. That was satisfying. 86, Dave Bedford was giving me a lot of advice. Dave was a shrewd old bugger, still is actually, when he's not drowning in a pint of beer.
What so every leap year then?
Exactly. I guess probably my second World Cross Country silver, because I was coaching myself. I'd taken myself off to Kenya for 5 weeks, got in fantastic shape. Yeah, I was, and Googie was out of sight. He was in the showers when I finished, but it was a good feeling.
And what happened in the showers? No, I'm joking. So, Steve, question for you.
He got beaten again.
Wiggins.
The winning length was even bigger. Steve, a bit more of a lighthearted question before we move on to some questions for both of you. Steve, would you rather Sunderland win the Premiership and the Champions League or bear in mind you coach one of these people, or Team GB do a clean sweep of the 1500 metre medals in Tokyo?
Sunderland win the Premier League and the Champions League.
I don't blame you at all, to be
no
fair.
No brainer. It ain't happening.
No, that's great. I mean, I must say, right, obviously, Steve, we used to have, you know, a lot of banter about, and I think when you were coaching me, actually, it was Newcastle who were in the shitter. And
I think
Sunderland,
we beat you about
we
six times
better.
In a row, didn't we? Was it six times? I can't remember now. Was it seven? I can't remember.
Who's had the last laugh? But anyway, no. That Sunderland Till I Die documentary was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. I'm saying that as if you were producing on it. You weren't. You're just a fan. Anyway, right, we've got some questions for the pair of you. And then this will round it off nicely. Then we'll do a quick what would you rather, and that'll wrap it up brilliantly. Okay, so for both of you, who was the greatest talent you raced against domestically or trained with that never made it? Take that to mean never won a medal or never made a major championship. So, it's a pretty clear question, actually. I don't need to summarise that anymore.
Domestic.
So best person you trained with domestically that never made it or should have. Do you know what I mean? So trained incredibly well, but never quite cut it when it came to competition level.
And in my case, probably Jeff Turnbull. He was a Geordie, funnily enough.
Yeah, he was good, Ted Land.
Jeff ran 8. I think he ran 13:21, but was worth a lot quicker. He ran about 8:16 for 2 miles. Had a lot of injuries. Super talented, but didn't make any teams really.
And do you think he could have, like, if he hadn't been injured, he would have been a 13:5 guy or something? Do you think, because you would have seen him training, so do you think that's the type of... them desperados are coming back up.
Well, Crammy would probably say it's because he was a drunken Geordie and he was coached by Lindsay Dunn, bless him, who left us not long ago, and in a different life would have made more teams and stuff. But, and I'll just throw out Jeff. There's probably half a dozen names I could throw up who you know, and that was the 80s for you. You could be 10th in the world and not make the 5,000 team. You could be sixth in the world and not make our 1,500 team. It was. There were tough days.
Steve, for you, obviously we've got Sharpie, who David Shaw probably never quite reached the levels he should.
I was thinking to say without a doubt the most talented was Sharpie. I mean, just
Do you think he was like? And I don't mean this to be like a muggy comment. Do you think he could have been better than you? Like, do you think that's the level of talent?
He was a different athlete, but he had. I mean, what people forget about him, when he won the World Junior 800 meters, he was also fourth or fifth in the 1500. Mm. And one of those Kenyans won a medal in 88. So, actually two of them, one in the 5,000, one in the 15. So, you know, he was doubling up at the World Juniors in 1986, was that? But he got pigeonholed into the 800, is what these tend to happen. And I used to keep going, look, Scott, you know, and I remember him running a 10K road race, a South Shields road race, where he ran, you know, well under 30 minutes when he was doing the right. But then he just got, I mean, he picked the minute. But how good could he have been? I don't know. He was a great racer, which was, he was always exciting to watch. But he just never quite got the infrastructure around himself, even though he was with me a lot and around time Jimmy and I a lot, that ever got that stability that he really needed to take himself to the absolute highest level. And I mean that in the nicest way, because he was a very funny guy and massive talent. Yeah, so I mean, domestically, I don't know, it's difficult. I mean, he is one that stands out. I mean, I've seen lots of good guys and probably seen quite a few in recent years as well. And you think, wow, you know, look, the thing is, talent is just, it's not the big thing. You know, the talent is, it's good to have it, but, you know, you need so many other things to go well. And you've got to have the right mentality. One of my other training partners, you'll know, a lad called Dave Slipper. You know, Slips he's still a good mate. And Slips what I couldn't understand is how he couldn't run faster on a Saturday. Because his trait, you know, he was doing parts of our sessions, most of our sessions, and I'd go, and I'm running 3:30, and he was running like 3:44, you know, and making that look hard.
But we see that now. I've even seen that as well, where, you know, I've been training people who've been running with me and I was running 3:34 and they'd been run 3:43. And it's like, So I think it was actually Andy Graffin. I had a conversation with him once and I think he summed it up really, really well. He said you need three things, like being quite reductive about it. You need three things to be a world-class athlete. You need the physiological talent, which is true. You need the injury robustness or injury resilience. And you also need the mental fortitude for it. So you need those three things. And if you've got those three things, you should be okay. And it's like, for me personally, I would say I had the talent and the mental fortitude, but I didn't have the injury resilience. That was the thing that let me down. And so obviously for you, Steve, you clearly had all three because you achieved, and the same for you. I think Colin probably Colin had the talent and he had the injury resilience, but I think it's fair to say, and I don't want to be a dick, but you probably didn't have the mental fortitude for it. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's, I think,
it's, do you think that's dick. It?
Sorry,
that's fair.
But Colin was super, super talented, Colin could have been a 3:31 runner and making world medals and everything. But it's like, do you think that's a fair thing? Those three key things are a thing that you need to reach the top.
Yeah, but the thing is, Ross, within each of those three things, there's a myriad of other stuff that make those three things work. You know, so yeah, it's a very complicated. You know, there's lots of people, I think, have ability, absolutely, and you know, that's never the determinant, really, at the end of the day.
I was gonna say you need the ability, you need the mental fortitude, and you need some luck. Luck really is the word, because how many people are world number one for 3 years and get injured a week for the Olympics or whatever? Mm. You know?
And then finally, a question for both of you. So, if you were both athletes now, and you could let you
live there.
Yeah, 537 miles coming back, Masters, World Masters next year. You can locate yourself anywhere in the world to set up, to live and train, where it provides a great balance of facilities, natural running environment, where you can still enjoy Wi-Fi and a good pint. your athletes now. Sorry about that. I've got work things going off there. If you could locate yourself anywhere in the world now to train, if you're an athlete, where would you go?
Tim?
You know, I've never even been there, but there are one or two venues, like Flagstaff, where everybody seems to go and everything's pretty good. I don't know about Park City. There was a lot of rain there last time you were there, wasn't there, Steve? Boulder, I've never been to. St Moritz is fantastic, but it's only good for 4 or 5 months before the snow kicks in again.
And you're bankrupt.
Well, there is that, the minor point. Yeah, yeah. And you can nearly get arrested for driving up the wrong lane like I did in about 1989. And I'm not
to be fair, though, you did have 12 pints, so...
I was definitely in my car. So yeah, probably the States. There's so much choice there. You know,
Flagstaff's amazing.
I've heard about so many places.
Yeah, Flagstaff's probably like of all the places I went to get that real balance of good weather, good running, good facilities, but also being able to enjoy normal life. Like Flagstaff was the best. Steve.
Yeah, I've got a real soft spot for Boulder, but the downside, as Tim said, would be weather for big chunks of the year. So if it was year-round, I loved Australia as well, but I think if you're an athlete today, you'd want to go altitude somewhere. I was just whispering. I mean, I do really enjoy going to South Africa. We love Potch in that area, but probably not sure I necessarily would be happy to be there like year-round necessarily. Can I move about a bit? Is that all right?
Yeah,
kind of Boulder between April and September, Australia from September to January, and Potch from January till April.
I mean, you did look like you enjoyed you Kenya go. When you used to sit there in your Speedos sunning it up.
Yeah, the thing I do like Kenya. I mean, you know, we have a Cocoa, our charity. We do a lot of work in Africa, in Kenya and Tanzania and the rest of it. So I do the bits that you guys all saw, and you know, the athletic bubble in Kenya is a weird one, as we all know. But I do enjoy Africa generally, and I think you know that whole the rest of the country and that part of the world is still fascinating. So. But yeah, from enough to base yourself there permanently, nah.
And then finally, so we always do a what would you rather question, and I wanted to keep it relatively athletics related for you both. So finally, would you rather have achieved everything you achieved but have done it now in 2020 and obviously, you know, let's say 2015 to 2020, or are you happy having done it when you did in the 80s?
For me, 100% back in the 80s, was more people watching, more people engaged, and I wouldn't have had to do any social media stuff.
No TikTok.
My head.
All these daft podcasts.
My head couldn't have coped with the modern world of celebrity, as it were, in the modern world. The good thing about the 80s, you could do your thing, go home, switch off, shut the door, and it was gone.
I would agree with you, Steve, but for my vanity, because nowadays you get so much more attention and assistance if you're a pretty good runner. Just things in perspective. When I came fourth in the Olympics, I wasn't interviewed after the race. You didn't get a medal. You're a bum. You know, nobody was interested. On the plane on the way back, Andy Norman came up to me and he's going around the plane with a bit of paper and a pen and signing up people for a meet at Crystal Palace a week later. And he's going, oh, bloody hell, Hutchings, there's another one I've got to be nice to. All right, a couple of $1,000, all right. You know, it was only Steve would know that was a good impression.
It was not bad.
Nowadays, you are celebrated. You get a letterbox in your village painted gold or silver or fourth colour or whatever. Back then, nobody really gave a toss.
Brown, it that one, Tim. Brown.
Well, you should know.
Yeah, I've been there.
I'm steady. Anyway. Ross, have you gone?
No, I'm here.
Next question.
I'm just letting you go. Anyway, well, that was it, guys, really. So,
okay, I thought, good.
Look, listen, we could have sat here and we could have talked for 2 hours, but great. I've really enjoyed chatting to you. Me and Colin would probably be happy to do it again if you ever wanted to do a part two, I feel. But yeah, just to thank you.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, just to wind Tim up. But we just want to say, obviously, good luck with the Durham City events this weekend. Tim, all the best with Brighton Marathon. I hope you know that gets a go-ahead and you can get cracking on with that. But guys, if you're still tuned in, all five of you.
Can I give a quick plug, Ross? On Sunday.
Coach me, doesn't know my name.
So apart from the runs, on Sunday, if you've enjoyed listening to this or watching this, we've got a special question of sport. University of Durham are one of our sponsors. And we've got some celebs, Paula Radcliffe, Jeanette Quachi, and Colin Jackson are the team captains.
Oh, I thought it was me there for a second.
And, who are the celebs?
I'm asking the questions. So, but yeah, tune into that and see. Test your knowledge. Oh, yeah, and I'm doing Lewis Moses is interviewing me tomorrow specifically about the mile. Very not my 5:41, 37 one, but yeah, a little bit faster than that. I won't tell you how fast Lewis did for his mile. Do you want to know?
Yeah, go on, Tom.
Sub five, didn't he?
4:20.
That's good, that. Yeah. He's still skinny. He's not like me.
He had 4% on as well.
Yeah.
I'm coming with Tim with these Right, great. Well, thank you very much, guys. Thank you, everybody, for listening, whether it's been live or whether it's retrospectively in the coming weeks. We hope you've all enjoyed it.
Thanks, Ross. Cheers, Colin.
Cheers, guys.
See you later. Thank you.
Bye. Steven, see you soon. Bye. Bye.